Welcome to Sundays with Andy. I'm Leslie Merle, Assistant Curator of Education, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our series of artist-led tours. In case you're just wandering up and didn't leave your house to come here specifically for this, this is Sundays with Andy. We meet at 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoons during the run of the exhibition Andy Warhol, The Last Decade. And we have three more lectures. Today we have Dan Blagg. Next week on May 9th we have Pat Kelly. And on May 16th, Jeff Zilm. We are so fortunate to have Daniel Blagg as our leader today. He is part of Art Space 111, and you might have seen his recent show, Paintings, Prints, and Presents, that he was included in. Or you might have seen his recent solo show in September of 2009 titled Thrashing About. You may also have encountered his piece, Spirit Walk, at the DFW airport. His work features kind of a photorealistic images of both rural and urban sites, and often the sites are right on the cusp of the intersection of nature and culture. His work is featured in the collections of the Museum of South Texas in Corpus Christi and the Tyler Art Museum. So please join me in welcoming Daniel Blagg. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm just going to talk loosely about this show and kind of take you through. I'm not going to get too far into the history of Andy Warhol, but I will talk to you about my response to his painting, some of the things I see, some of the things that he went through, and we'll cover it in that manner. And hopefully we'll all get through this painlessly. So let's go ahead and enter the main room here. We'll start right here with the Andy Warhol wallpaper, which is something he actually did. I don't know whose rooms are graced with it, but it is interesting. It's a portrait that when he's young, and it's complimentary, which is opposed to some of the other portraits that we have before us here. These portraits are specifically done at a time when Andy Warhol was going through a lot of self-doubt, which any artist worth his salt goes through, I think, at some point of his career, and questions themselves and what they're doing and if they hit a wall creatively or not. And you can see the kind of the strangulation situation. I think there's a lot of comedy in some of Warhol's, a lot of humor, and a lot of ironic humor as well that I see in his work that he does, and it pervades all along through all the years, starting with the Brillo boxes and moving forward throughout his career. He was a very innovative artist. He employed a variety of mediums to say the things that he wanted to say and do the things that he wanted to do. He had crews working on his work. He visualized it, he expressed it, and they carried it out. And then he sort of was like the Rubens of the modern era, in a way, very prolific, doing very interesting stuff. The one portrait I think that really, to me, capsulizes his self-doubt is this one. It really shows this, particularly this face here. If you look at it, there's a lost and kind of forlorn expression there in the midst of trying to ho-hum the rest of it through with the other two faces that appear juxtaposition, giving movement and kind of the side to side of the head, whether shaking no or not, I'm not sure, but it is a very vulnerable portrait of an artist who felt vulnerable for no good reason, really. He was secure in his place in art history. He wasn't the founder of the pop movement. You could say that goes to Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, but he was the guy in which that movement crystallized around and came into sharp focus. And almost he stole the identity of the movement from them. And he was a very, very interesting artist. I think he'll always go down in history as that, and his work will always, the variety of things you're going to see here, where he was a very skilled drawer. He could really, a draftsman, and he could draw very well and letter very well by hand. And throughout his career, he started that way, and then he went into the mechanical image and explored that, and for years did that. He actually, at one point, hated painting. And then, as you'll see later, it was Jean-Michel Basquiat who actually came by, and they got together and actually got him back in love with the visual language of the paintbrush in the hand and the expression of what he wanted to express. The paintings behind you, the Shadow series, which are, I think, you know, Warhol went to New York in 49. He was kind of there through the 50s. And he really was in the heyday of the abstract expressionist movement. And these paintings, to me, are a homage to that era. And these are the paintings that he did after his period of self-doubt. And he got really good critical reviews on them, and I think they kind of lifted him on and spurred him forward in a way. But they're very simple, and there was actually a whole set of them that would probably line this whole gallery originally when he showed them. And I think of, you know, Franz Klein, an abstract painter in the 50s in New York who was very famous, and I kind of think of him when I see these because of just the structure, and if you ever have a chance, look up Franz Klein's work, and I think you'll see the connection. And then on this celebrity wall is just kind of that Warhol immersed himself with celebrities. I don't know if it was a career move or it's just part of being in New York, but it's a very interesting, you can see what an interesting life he had and the acquaintances throughout his life with artists and celebrities alike. And for this guy who trafficked in all these arenas to meet up with Basquiat in his later life, and for Basquiat to have the influence that he had, was pretty remarkable to me that he was so open and so available that he could let something like that happen in the midst of dealing with all the things and all the people that he met throughout his life. It's a very interesting phenomenon. It says a lot about sort of the lack of ego and the open innocence that Warhol, in my mind, possessed. And then over here is a portrait that he did, a series of portraits that were done. This is also, it's like in 1986. And Basquiat, I think he was intrigued with Basquiat's hairdo and decided he would try one, and he really liked the way it came out, and it's sort of a quintessential portrait of him. As in, you know, he had this interesting veneer of being very frail and very vulnerable and kind of quirky. He spoke very softly, and his demeanor was almost meek, but he was anything but with his art, definitely. Okay, we'll move into the next room. This is kind of the abstract room. It's where he deals with abstract painting and his flirtations with it. You have at the end of each gallery what are called the Rorschach paintings. And Warhol actually had a gallery assistant. He approached one of his gallery assistants and said, "I need something to paint. What can I paint?" And so the guy said, "Well, we'll dig up some stuff you did in I think it was Carnegie Institute when he went there that dealt with Rorschach images." And so what he did was he blew them up grandly and painted the metallic paint, blew them up, actually had them in his studio. I'm not sure. I think they were hand-done. They had to be because they were done on a floor and then they were folded like a giant Rorschach deal. And, you know, I'm not sure what his message was. I mean, they almost appear Tibetan to me. And I don't know why. You know, they sort of do. They have an ancient quality in them that makes them very interesting, and whether it's his concept of the mind and the largeness of the mind and the psychological impact of what, you know, a Rorschach test would look like on a monumental scale. And then we have the oxidation paintings. which were done kind of just before he went into his nosedive, sort of. I think he, if I'm not correct, yeah, it was around the late 70s on that. And he, you know, he, at one point he had people coming, streaming through the studio and peeing on his paintings, which might have sent him into a nosedive. I don't know, but it's an interesting result. I can't say I'm a huge fan of them. I mean, there are a lot of things of his that I like much better. But they're very, you know, they are what they are, and they're sort of a monochromatic play on oxidation. And, you know, I think it probably at this point he was sort of fixated on a lot of things, including his doubt. And I guess if you've got someone coming in and peeing on your paintings, you are kind of at the end of your rope in some ways. You know? So I think that was one of the issues. And it is funny. I can't help it, you know. But back this way, Warhol had this way of almost filtering himself from his own work. And I'm sure when he did these images here, the yarn paintings, I'm sure within a week's time he was sick to his stomach of hearing about Jackson Pollock. Because, I mean, it really does hearken to Pollock, but it has that Warhol kind of sterile, clean, removed touch, you know, that there's something between him and the actual work. And I thought, well, okay, so he soaked all these yarns in paint and then he threw them down, but that wasn't it at all. He actually had them kind of photostated, silk screened on in layers and colors. That was a process that he had become used to. In what I call the age of, in his period of mechanical painting, which reappears in his work over the years. And it's an interesting quality. I really love them. I do see the resemblance to Pollock, but I also see a lot of Warhol's kind of, a phrase I'll probably use here is kind of this distilled spontaneity, you know, in his work. And it's because the process would kind of distill the spontaneity that he suffered. There is some spontaneity in these things, but it's a little chloroformed, a little filtered, and it's a little bit removed. And these are very distilled, the camouflage paintings, which I think also may be his revisiting abstract expressionism in America, which, you know, through the 50s and the 60s dominated New York. And since he was there, he probably, I don't know, I think that he kind of paid a homage to that with these. There are two in the other room that I like very much. This one, it sort of is, you know, it's so sterile in some ways that it's not alluring to me as the other ones are. And then back over here, we'll dash in here real quick. On these Easter egg things, you know, I've read a lot of things about Easter and there's Christian and whatever. I'm not sure what you want to read into it, but I mean, I think that it's a simple painting. It's a lot of fun. It's got color. It's got, I love the black, and I just like, you know, it's spontaneous. It's kind of whimsical, like Warhol. I wouldn't want to tie a whole lot of meaning up into it in any way, shape, or form, other than I think he just really liked shapes, and he really liked the spill of this whole composition. And, you know, he's got one that's lost out here on the edge. And I think that there's a real deft compositional consideration going on in there that he is employing and that he is taking advantage of. And I know that there's a, you know, he was Catholic and very caught up in that. And you'll see that in his later paintings. It becomes very you know, very visible in his later paintings and Da Vinci and other things that he got caught up with that we will visit here probably in the next room or two. So let's go back and then over to the other gallery there. Can everybody hear me?
Where's your picture at the airport?
Oh, it's in the B terminal. It's on the floor, the catwalk. It's a terrazzo floor thing.
It's terrazzo floor?
Yeah, there's two of them there.
Oh, seems so. Okay.
Yeah.
B. B what?
I think both Bs, one and two. You know, the catwalk is like the tram section. Okay, we're right here at the gun. This is 1982. It is, technically to me, it kind of speaks of his early work in the 60s. It has that imprint, that kind of Kotelev removed image. And this is a really strong piece to me, and it has a lot of, there's a lot of suppressed kind of violence and weirdness in it, the shaking hand, the gun, the blood red color that evokes a violence to me. And it's a lot of, I love the word high standard, you know, there in a 22 caliber handgun. And the use of metallic paint on the surface and the reflective quality of that, also the reflective quality of metal that he incorporated. And some of those are just little ingenious touches that he would do and take to make a, you know, he just didn't let, the thing I liked about Warhol, he just didn't let any kish get in his way. I mean, even if it was schmaltzy, he would do it just to get the effect that he wanted. And it's, and that's one of the things I really, you know, share with him, is that I'll do anything to get an image to do what I want it to do. And I'm just about apt to paint anything to do what I wanted to do or say what I wanted to say. And I think Warhol really was very, very astute at that and very good. And even though he had people working for him and people doing all these things, you can bet he did all the cropping. He did a lot of the decision making. And when he saw something was right, he went with it, whether somebody else did it for him or not. He didn't have any real hang-ups about that. And there's a fresh quality about his, once again, that kind of openness that he had and the ability to see when something was right, whether he had, you know, you could change his mind, literally. But this is very interesting piece to me. It, you know, it smacks in America where there's a lot of these things floating around, and not, whether it's a comment on what happened to him. You know, he was shot in 1967. I think he was shot five times with a .357 Magnum and almost killed. And, you know, and whether he's exercising that last sight that he saw or whatever when that happened is something, I mean, I could only, you know, speculate on. But he, you know, he went through a thing where he was doing objects. And there was an important show that he did with objects and stuff, and they pulled the knives and the guns out of the show, and he got panned really bad in a review, and he blamed the gallery and the whole nine yards on that. And I think he had a point. You know, he wanted to have some stuff in there that would shake him up, and they took it out and edited it for, you know, for whatever reasons, I guess for sellable reasons or whatever. And, you know, it's an iconic American image, like it or not. It really is. And then over here, a couple of the Rorschach paintings. Now, these are the, I'm sorry, camouflage paintings. And I really do love the one on, well, I like them both. I mean, I love the idea that he was arbitrary in the color and took that off. And I think there's a really nice, fresh, there's even a spontaneity, even though it's very measured and very calculated. The color gives it that spontaneity, I think, that is, you know, prevalent throughout his work. And there's a slight, you know, tone of wry humor about abstract expressionism and validity and whatnot, you know, that you want to read into it. And the lines of these images are the same. The colors make them different. And you see different paintings because of the value tones of the colors. And you're visualizing something very, very different. But at the same time, they're, you know, I think they're fun. I think they're cool, and they're very much Warhol. They're very much what he was about in doing his work. Okay, we'll move over into the next one. sometime in the mid-80s, Andy Warhol had returned to the hand-painted image where he employed his skills in drawing and painting. And it was Jean-Michel Basquiat that actually got him into that mode. Basquiat was a very visceral painter from the streets who did a lot of graffiti and stuff like that, but he had a real faculty for just throwing an image down in a reckless, painterly, haphazard manner, very free-flowing, very spare, and something which is rarely done, you know, with any young artist. And Warhol was very fascinated by that because it was very different from what he did. And it was very different from his approach to art. And it kind of went back to his early days in the 60s when he did it. And I think really what I found with these two guys that really made their things work was that one was visceral and the other one was very measured. And you had these opposite things happening on a canvas. And they seemed to complement each other. They let enough of each other come through so that you saw a little of both of them. And then in that collaboration, they did really special stuff. I really loved them. Now, when they threw a third artist in the mix, which is over in the corner, Francesco Clemente, who I think is a good painter, but I think when they threw him into the mix, somebody spoiled the soup. You know, I'm sorry, it just doesn't do a thing for me. It's too confused. It's too muddled. I think there's too many chefs in the kitchen on this. And the best part of it is where Warhol is, where you see him, I think, is the best part of this. And the rest, I mean, I just think when they've got the three of these guys together, and especially, I mean, maybe there are some success stories. I didn't see them in this exhibit, and that's just my opinion. But I think that it just became so muddled and muddy to me that I didn't see it as a good painting. You know? And then when I, like this one here, it's quintessential Warhol. It really, you know, it speaks of the religious overtones that he is concerned with. It touches on, you know, Christ and the body and, you know, the religious overtones of the body and the death of Christ and the shedding of the body and becoming the Savior and all the drama inherent in that, I think is, and yet this is very funny. It's almost humorous. It's sort of tongue-in-cheek humor of some ad, you know, bodybuilding ad in the back of a magazine that's slapped on in a very painterly manner, which I think when Warhol hooked up with Basquiat, that he actually unleashed a lot of Warhol's spontaneity of the wrist and actually made him more direct in dealing with his paintings. And I just think there's like this little group of paintings here that's just, they're so fun. They're almost like, you know, what we used to see in the back of Boys Life magazine ads, like the X-ray glasses or the kind of graphics that you had there that he took upon himself to do. And, you know, even going back to the Campbell soup can and rendering it, but there's a lot of skill in his ability to draw, and he still had that. And I think it shows really in these works. I especially like the Reagan defense budget. Okay, and the next big room. Notice on the right here, notice as you pass the Marilyn Monroe, as you get past it, almost past it, the white of the wall puts it in a positive deal. I don't know if it's if you can see it, but if you go past it on the wall, you'll see it positively light up to a positive image instead of a negative. It's really something that one of the last things that Andy Warhol was very interested in was the Last Supper and before he died. And whether he saw his death coming or something, I imagine if you've survived being shot five times, you have sort of a fatalistic attitude about things. And you might feel that it is stalking, your vulnerability is exposed like that. This is almost, the two of these add up to almost the size of the actual Da Vinci painting, minus the obvious height that would have been there. The color of it, there's almost a sickly feeling about it. It has a kind of, as though he knows he's dying, and the somberness is all expressed. Of course, he owes so much of this to Da Vinci, but at the same time, and then the repetition of it is something that, it's a motif that he used from the Campbell soup cans, and he kept using all through his life, was a repetitive image, and the slight variances and nuances. And I think it was one of the things, Donald Sultan once said that an artist has 18 seconds. Because that's the time that most people will spend with a painting. And I think Warhol, by repeating these images, made us spend more time on his work and begin to pick out, why did you do that? There are nuances that are different. What do they mean? Or do they mean anything? And I think that was one of the things that he employed on this. This piece over here, the 55, is just another deal where I think where you could see the spontaneity that crept into his work via Basquiat and some of these large images that he did. And then behind us are two very interesting images here. I particularly like this one, "And Sin No More." It reminds me of Philip Guston's work, and it's very raw, it's very undone, it's just scrawled on, and I can see where a lot of it is Basquiat, and you can see that this is probably Warhol here. Well, he would prepare these things for Basquiat, these huge canvases, just have them there so that when he came in or get him in there, he would just let him loose on it. And it really is an amazing comment on an artist who was so successful, so accomplished, that he would suspend his ego for this young, kind of visceral street artist who was kind of edgy, who most people were not taking seriously, and give him a surface to share with him in such a way. It is a remarkable testimony to Warhol's sort of lack of ego and his willingness to stay open about what he was doing. And I read into this some funny things. Warhol is very Catholic. There's sort of like, "And sin no more," and you've got the wholesome glass of milk, and you got the little envelopes where all the sins are getting stuffed and stored away, and the vulnerability of all that. The manila envelope, and even made in Taiwan. And so, there's, and I'm not sure what all of this scrawling is about, but the sort of like almost fingerprints on the envelope, pressing it shut, keep all that out, the vulnerabilities of human frailties that happen in life. And I think it was just kind of it's a funny piece of work. And sin more is what it says, actually. But it says, he's cut it off from "and sin no more." But it's a very, very interesting thing. And whether it has to do with his Catholic upbringing and how the Catholic faith approaches and looks at sin and cleansing itself is a question that is, I can just speculate about. But I sort of read it in there in that way. And I'm not sure what Basquiat's connection to that was, or whether he was dictated to do the milk, whether it just happened that way. And then this is the, you know, the Last Supper painting, executed in 86, a very prolific time for Warhol. A lot of this show is done in 86. He died in 87. And it's an interesting piece. There's a lot I could read into it. The $6.99 price tag, the big C, which is what John Wayne called cancer. And whether there's a connection there, I'm not sure of. And the transitory thing about the motorcycles, the eagle, which looks like a colonel's pin or something, and, the wisdom of the owl and Christ in the midst of his betrayals. And it's a very odd piece, but it does have that, it has this quiet, kind of measured spontaneity that is very, very prevalent in these years when he broke loose of the silk screen and got into actually just painting the image rather viscerally on the canvas. And it is huge. I don't know. Does anyone have room for this in your house? I'm not sure. And the drips, I'm not sure what to read into a lot of this. It's a very mysterious thing. Once again, the repetition of Christ three times, what that says is just one, it's open-ended. You could read a lot into it. Actually, it's 4 times that he's in here. And the motorcycles, they represent, to me, kind of the spirit of jumping on something and flying and moving forward and escaping, whether it's our mortal selves or what. Okay, now we'll move to this last room. These films are interesting. I have watched them, and they're worth watching. You get a real sense of the guy and that kind of meek, understated attitude. He reminds me of a friend of mine, Murray Smither. The detail of the Last Supper, 112 times. And I'm not sure... I'm sort of I grew up in a Baptist upbringing, but I'm not really affiliated with any church per se. And, when my mother was, when I was young, she had a book on all the world religions and kind of read that and kind of got an overall feel about what things, and I always felt like there was a real, kind of similarity between so many, sort of the structure of religion and what it was. And to the, whether this is Warhol's comment, to me it's the comment of the drumbeat of religion and the figure in religion that's most important to some people and how it is drummed into our psyche and conditions us from a very young age. And being Catholic, I know that had to happen to Warhol. Most of my Catholic friends are always talking about Catholic guilt, Catholic this, Catholic that. And I think that, there's something about this where all these just kind of repetitions make Christ, a little more familiar in a way and make him a little more informal, which is, I'm sure, what Christ would have preferred to be. And he was, I think, in his own nature from what I gathered reading about him. But the electric quality of the negative and the yellow and the dark and the real kind of shocking quality also gives it a pulsation to me that comes at you in a very, very strong way. It's quite a strong piece of work. It's an interesting idea. I couldn't imagine how he fathomed to do it. The number in here, This camouflage portrait is one of the most interesting portraits of an artist that I think I've ever seen. It really is moody. It's sort of mysterious. And at the same time, it's the psychological, you know, the camouflage and the psychological part of kind of keeping ourselves to ourselves, suppressing our inward selves in some way, whether out of our own insecurities or whatever psychological dilemmas that may exist. It's a very vulnerable portrait. It's very interesting in the way that he did it. The glasses, kind of the sweet, you know, face rather than the scowling scarecrow thing that he had earlier, which is behind you as well. He's a year away from his death. Whether he sees it coming, I don't know. But you feel it in this. You really do feel it. And I think it's a alarming piece of work. I was surprised when I saw it. And I've been familiar with Warhol's work over the years. But seeing some of these later things has been a real revelation about him, his own personal vulnerabilities, his fragile nature, and whether all that stems from, you know, being in New York and being who he was and what he did, it had to be a challenging and daunting thing to be thrust into celebritydom, the whole icon thing of being the artist of the pop movement and all the rest. And so this is a look in the mirror, in a way, to me, of himself. And the camouflage is maybe, you know, he's shown you some of himself through his work. I don't know that he was particularly expressive on a personal basis. From what I have seen and gathered, he was very reticent. One of the things I liked about him was that, and I've seen in his work, as we'll see around the corner, is his ability to lift the mundane into some special light. So we go back this way, and there's two more paintings to look at. Early on, Andy Warhol was a commercial artist, and I think he dragged that into a realm of fine art with these pieces. These are done, he started with the Brillo boxes and gravitated to the Campbell soup. These were actually done right after he was shot, and I think he had to revisit his starting point to kind of get his bearings again. But, you know, the repetition of the product, the stamped manufacturing thing, it influenced his painting so profoundly. It influenced the way he painted and what he painted. And he took consumer-driven images, incorporated them in his art in a way that no one had ever done before. And in doing that, he really lifted himself into a special place in American art, which I think he'll forever occupy. And that this art, which is also just like these Kansas suit, it's mass produced, it's stacked on a shelf in this place on a wall. And it shows us you get into the design of the can. Something you wouldn't do in the store when you had it in your hand. And in that way, he kind of separated you from the myth of consumer thinking, as a consumer to look at art in a different way and open it up to a wider scope. And I think he accomplished that in a very real way. I think he'll always be a very important American artist. And, you know, he did it in a fashion that suppressed his primal urges until Basquiat came along and loosened him up and freed him. He fell back in love with painting that he had fallen out of love with some 20-something years earlier and rekindled in it, and from some street kid that came along and kind of reacquainted him with his wrist, his fingers, the brush, and the paint. And the testimony is the next painting in the next room. Okay. I think the name of this piece is Dentures. I don't know if a dentist owns it or not, but here we are again. An artist, a great accomplishment, letting a young kid jump on a big canvas, turning him loose on top of his own work. Who would do this? No one that I know of. And I've asked all my artist friends. It's a daring move. He takes advantage of the primitive nature of Basquiat, the wild freedom that Basquiat exhibited, and has fallen back in love with the painted image, the hand-painted image. And just the idea that a guy of his accomplishment in the art world and his position to open himself up in such a way says so much for Warhol that I just cannot say enough for it. It was a brilliant thing to do. It did catapult Basquiat in a way that nothing else probably would have. He gave a hand up to a younger artist, which is something I try to do, and I've had friends that do that, and I think it's something you just got to do. You got to help them up the ladder because it's a tough climb up there. But this piece is, the raw nature really has, you know where Warhol is here, right in here, you can see where he just left it, and then he would let Basquiat come in and jump on these giant images and express himself in a way that, few artists would ever dare to do. And a lot of the things he did in his career were very daring. From the Campbell soup cans to this, and everything in between, he employed every medium you could think of. He did film. He was involved in a multitude of things, and he was always very interesting and incredibly productive in his last year of his life. And he will leave a testimony that will stand the test of time. Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.